out of 77. Ah, Star Wars, nothing but Star Wars. Give me the Star Wars, don't let them end.
Hello and welcome back to a bounty hunterific episode of Give Me Those Star Wars, the once and future premier Star Wars show on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Ryan Daly, and I told you last time I would be back to cover Star Wars stories published by Dark Horse Comics in the 1990s. While I never meant for that to be taken seriously, I wasn't lying. The irredeemable Shag already sniped May the 4th for an episode of his Marvel Star Wars podcast, which, if you haven't listened to by now, get to that. But later this week, a brand new Star Wars movie arrives in theaters. For me to not release an episode of Give Me Those Star Wars to capitalize on The Mandalorian and Grogu would be professionally irresponsible. And y'all know, when it comes to podcasting, I am the utmost professional. This episode, I, along with my guest, who is waiting patiently for me to introduce him, hang on a couple seconds longer, we'll be tapping into the Mandalorian movie hype by reviewing a comic about a character who kind of looks like the Mandalorian. Actually, two characters who look like the Mandalorian. The deadly bounty hunter Boba Fett and his wannabe replacement, the slightly less deadly Jodo Cast. Before that, however, I want to welcome my special guest this episode, making his first appearance on Give Me Those Star Wars. Please welcome Captain Entropy. What's up, Captain?
Hey, Ryan, how are you?
I'm doing really well, Thank you for this.
This place doesn't look as much like the cantina on Mos Eisley as I expected.
I cleared out all the riffraff.
Oh, good. That's why it's safer. Good.
Yeah. The floor is still kind of gross, but yeah. It's your first time. You get the question. What's your deal in terms of Star Wars? How familiar with you with the movies, the shows, and for the purposes of this conversation, how familiar or not are you with the comics?
I'm going to give you a long answer because it's complicated, but the short version is I consider myself a Star Wars dilettante. I am more knowledgeable than the average guy on the street, but not as knowledgeable as a lot of people on Fire and Water or in the Fire and Water orbit. So I've seen the first trilogy, the second trilogy, such as it is, and bits and pieces of the ones that have come out since then. My favorite is probably Rogue One. I've seen several of the TV series, but not all of them. And as far as the comics go, I read a few of the Marvel Star Wars comics from when, from when I was a kid. I have read some more of the ones that have come out recently. Particularly, there was one where Darth Vader was in a survival mode on a planet. And there have been a few things where it just was too appealing on the rack not to pick up. But I'm not a regular reader.
Was that the Vader down storyline when he crashed on a planet? Yeah, he crashed on a planet, and like there's like 1,000 rebels there trying to take him prisoner or capture him, and it's basically like the last scene of Rogue One when he just cuts loose on like those poor bastard rebels in that little hallway. It's like that times 1,000. It's like how much damage can this guy wreak?
Yeah, and I think they should have gone with Vader at his nadir, but I guess they're not much of a pun in the Star Wars universe.
I like that. That'd be a good title. Well, cool. I'm glad to kind of get to I like the way you said a dilettante. You know, more than the average, but less than the Fire and Water experts. I was like, no, that's kind of how I was about DC Comics when I started a Secret Origins podcast. So it's not a big deal, but.
Well, I mean, that worked out really well. So, okay, you've just boosted my confidence.
Yeah, this could launch you into a huge thing for Star Wars. Yeah, folks, today the captain is here to help me cover the story Boba Fett, Twin Engines of Destruction. Now, Dark Horse Comics, not Marvel, Dark Horse Comics published this story as a one-shot on January 15th, 1997. However, that was not the first time this story saw print. Twin Engines of Destruction was originally released in a serial format by the Topps publication Star Wars Galaxy Magazine, one of my favorite reads back in the 90s. the serialized story appeared in 4 8-page installments of the quarterly magazine, beginning in issue 5, released October of 1995, continuing in issues 6, 7, and 8, which came out in July 1996. If you want to follow along with us, the collected one-shot comic is available on Marvel Digital Unlimited. The story is written by Andy Mangles, penciled by John Nadeau, inked by Jordy Ensign, lettered by Michael Heisler, and colored by Kerry Porter. The collected edition from Dark Horse has a painted cover by Nadeau. A familiar-looking bounty hunter chases a pirate named Nostric to the planet Thuaka with another well-known bounty hunter, Dengar, right behind him. It doesn't take Dengar too long, though, to recognize that the man in the battle-damaged Mandalorian armor is not Boba Fett. It's Jodo Cast, a talented but sloppy and greedy mercenary who trades on Boba Fett's reputation in order to secure higher fees from clients. The real Boba McCoy is on the planet Nwildab, killing a charlatan who has been terrorizing settlers by pretending to be a Sith Lord. After Dengar tells Fett what Jodo Cast has been up to, Fett travels to Pequalis 3, posing as a man named Madak. As Madak, he visits the House of Benelux, part of the Bounty Hunter Guild. Madak specifically requests Jodo Cast to hunt down a man named Hillcrop. Were you able to follow that? Doesn't matter. Fett and Dengar travel to Nal Hutta and begin setting their trap. 6 days later, Jodo Cast arrives on Nal Hutta. He enters an abandoned stronghold where Hillcrop is supposedly hiding, but quickly discovers the whole place is booby-trapped with blast doors, laser webs, and vicious creatures called Quamila. Cast manages to blast his way through the traps to follow Hillcrop. He learns too late, though, that he was following a hologram that led him right to Boba Fett. From the safety of Boba Fett's ship, Dengar watches the fight play out. Jodo Cast surprises Fett by blowing him backwards with his jetpack. The two exchange fire, and then Jodo Cast tries to fly away. Boba Fett snares his ankle and flies after him. Fett disables Cast's jetpack and shoots him with a nerve toxin dart, sending the lesser bounty hunter plummeting to the floor. He strips the Mandalorian armor off Jodo Cast, saying that he didn't earn the right to wear it. Fett sabotages Cast's jetpack and leaves 3 vials on the ground next to Cast's conscious but broken body. Fett tells him one of the vials is an antidote, and if he manages to take it before the jetpack explodes, he might live. Boba Fett then leaves him and boards his ship, Slave One. Dengar asks why he gave Jodo Cast a chance to live. Fett doesn't believe that's what he did, and the two feel the tremor as the jetpack explodes. Slave One takes off and flies away from Nal Hutta and the corpse of Jodo Cast. All right. With this story being brand new to you, Captain, what did you think about this one?
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a neat slice of life, self-contained adventure for Boba Fett. And I thought it showed you a lot about his character. And I know you're not a fan of the TV show Book of Boba Fett. I watched it and enjoyed it, although I had some problems with it. But I will say, I remember in reading this, I thought this is more like I expected Boba Fett to be in the show.
This wasn't Dark Horse knew what they had in the character store. They did a lot of Boba Fett comics in the 90s, like a lot of one-shots and stuff. And this one was fairly typical for that type of thing, a fairly cool self-contained story. And this really cemented my idea of who this guy was and his place in the galaxy and the type of stories you tell with him. So when the prequels came along and Attack of the Clones specifically, that shows him as a 10-year-old kid, who's the clone, the clone slash son of this other guy who dresses and looks just like him. And then all of the clone troopers are from the same DNA. So it's like he's no longer special in that way. He's literally one of a billion. So I felt like that kind of damaged his rep. And then once they started the show, The Mandalorian, I was like, this is great. You're giving us everything cool about Boba Fett without any of the baggage. I was like, this [S2] Yep. [S1] Is the perfect way to do this. But then in season 2 of The Mandalorian, they brought Boba Fett back. Okay, what? Now you're just introducing another character who looks like the same, but has the baggage. And then when they when they announced the Book of Boba Fett, because it was teased at the end of season two, I did a whole episode where I was like really excited about the possibilities of you have the Mandalorian now on this trajectory of being honorable and decent and this family man and is only a father and like the whole lone wolf and cub aspect of him with Grogu.
Yep.
But Boba Fett can be, for lack of a better, he can be the asshole. He can be the mean guy. He can be the cruel, more sinister aspect of that. And like yeah. they set him up, he would be like the new crime lord of Tatooine. And I was like, this could be really cool. But I think Disney got gun shy. And they're like, well, wait a minute. We don't want the character to do the things that a gangster does. Like he can't hurt innocent people. He can't steal from innocent people. He can't extort money from the innocent people. He can't traffic in drugs or prostitutes or weapons or like other things. It's like, so he's just like the friendly neighborhood gangster. He's like just the mayor of Tatooine, basically. So my biggest problem with Book of Boba Fett was more conceptually, like what they set it up versus what they ended up doing with the story. I did think some of the episodes were really, really good. And some of like the interesting, like the stuff they did with him with the Tusken Raiders and that whole approach to their civilization and the kind of assimilation, cultural assimilation into that group, I thought was really, really interesting.
Yeah,
but ultimately, I was really disappointed by the show. And yeah, it left a bad taste in my mouth for the character, too, because now I'm like, why did you bring him back in the first place when you never needed to?
Yeah, I think we have similar complaints because, I mean, the thing that kept popping up in my head as I was watching it was he's not killing the people he should be killing. And like the people who are most likely to come back and be a danger to him, he's not doing the thing that he does in this book. Right.
Right.
And he's not setting the examples or making examples out of people in the way that he should. I was OK with him being a little bit more honorable of a crime lord in the way of like, I don't know if you read any of John Byrne's Generation stuff. But in part of that, Bruce Wayne becomes Ra's al Ghul, essentially. But he
that'd be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, he morphs the nature of Ra's al Ghul's criminal network into something that's actually doing good. It just it's operating like a criminal network. It's essentially an outlaw. It's outlaw philanthropy, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't expect Boba Fett to go that far because he's not a good guy. Mm-hmm. But I guess I could have imagined him being somewhat more moral than Jabba or one of the Hutts, but never weak. And I think he came across sometimes.
Yeah. One of the other things that, I mean, we see in this story, and it was kind of a major piece of Boba Fett in the pre-prequel area, so like the 80s and 90s expanded universe, whether it was in the novels by Del Rey or the comics by Dark Horse, was the sort of weird kind of partnership between Boba Fett and Dengar. Because in the lore of this era, Dengar saves him from the Sarlacc. Well, sort of. Boba Fett gets out of there on his own. He manages to escape the Sarlacc. But then he's just wandering in the desert, dehydrated, his body charred to a crisp, at the verge of death. And it's not like the Tusken Raiders or the Jawas we find him. It's Dengar is just flying around. Dengar catches him and kind of saves him life and brings him back. But then it's almost like a codependent relationship kind of at sometimes depending on the depiction. But it's like they're not partners, but they're kind of like he helps him a lot along some of the ways. They kind of work together in certain things. And maybe it was interesting because of the six bounty hunters that we saw very briefly in The Empire Strikes Back, Boba Fett and Dengar were the only two humans. So it's kind of interesting that maybe that was a bit of a connection. But I did think that was something that maybe a missed opportunity of the Book of Boba Fett was not revisiting some of those familiar faces. And I feel somewhat hypocritical because I've gotten to the point where I'm really championing seeing new ideas and new concepts and new characters in Star Wars and not relying so much on the nostalgia of the friendly stuff. But I'm also kind of like, why didn't we see Bosk in the Book of Boba Fett? Why didn't we see Dengar or IG-88 or 4LOM, some of those guys? That would have been fun.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think we all have the thing where it's like the aspects that we most like, we want to see again when somebody does a reboot or even just an extension of the story. And we see that in all kinds of comics, right? Where it's like I mean, especially in DC because they do so many reboots and you can tell what the author likes because that's what he brings back.
Sure.
And then he leaves your favorite thing behind.
Yeah. That's why so many, like, the new generation of heroes that were created right after Crisis, whether it's like Wally as Flash, or then like the introduction of Kyle Rayner and Dick Grayson, or not, sorry, and Tim Drake, and a lot of those characters that kind of became the new generation. Well, then a new crop of writers takes over, and they want the generation before that that they fell in love with, and or they introduce new characters to be their own little windows. And you end up like, I think the biggest problem now is so many of these legacy heroes at DC end up getting middle child syndrome, where they're just kind of like stuck as like this forgotten thing because they keep creating like a new toy, a new kid to kind of tag along with.
Yeah, well, it's like Connor Hawke at DC. You know, there was a period of time where it's like, okay, he's going to be Green Arrow now. This is a legacy thing. We're moving on. He's Green Arrow. And then exactly what you said happened.
Yeah. The character Jodo cast is kind of interesting because, I mean, we see him in the story and we see his death in the story. His flame, I guess you could say, burned bright, but burned quickly in this era. He was created actually for a story module from the Star Wars role-playing game in 1988. And the reason he was created as a surrogate for Boba Fett, because at that point, Boba Fett was still dead. Like, they kind of kept that over from Marvel Comics and in the things. It wasn't until the 90s with Dark Empire that they brought Boba Fett back officially and then created the lore about how he came back. So that was 92, 91. But at the time, the role-playing game wanted somebody who looked like Boba Fett to wear that cool armor because they know how badass that armor looks. And it's kind of funny to think about that now because the armor is just omnipresent, practically ubiquitous in Star Wars now because of the armies of Mandalorians, not just one, but like several armies over generations that we see in the Clone Wars, in Rebels. You've got the Loyalists, the Night Watch, the Darth Maul Mandalorians that have horns on their helmets. And then in like the Mandalorian show now, you can't get away from that armor. And that's the thing. Like, it doesn't feel special anymore. But at this era, when I was reading the story at the beginning, I was like, it really did. And it was cool to see a second guy wearing that armor. It was a novelty. And Jodo cast, he made appearance in a few other Star Wars comics, but also the novella Side Trip, which was eventually collected in one of their anthology books, but was also published for the one of their role-playing game magazines. And that was co-written by Timothy Zahn and Michael Stackpole, who were two of the best writers of Star Wars books at that time. And oddly, in that story, Jodo cast is not Jodo cast. He is another famous Star Wars character dressed as Jodo cast as kind of a disguise. It's weird, but doesn't matter.
The imposter is imposter. All right.
Yeah, exactly. And then there was a Star Wars video game called The Knights of Terras Kazi, which was a fighting style game. It was basically Street Fighter or Mortal Kombat in Star Wars. And you could be 10 different characters, maybe 8 different characters. And if you beat the game, if you beat all the other fighters with that character, you unlocked a new character, which was basically your character in a different skin. Like, if you played as Jedi Knight Luke Skywalker in the black outfit and you beat the game, you could unlock him wearing his Bespin outfit, his kind of grayish olive, like tan fatigues. You could unlock the Bespin Han Solo with the jacket. If you beat the game with Boba Fett, it said you unlocked Jodo cast. But again, it's the same skin. It's just painted colored slightly differently. But I was like, yeah, he's the character you can unlock in a video game. That was cool.
So I was just looking up, like, I agree with you that, and it's another dilemma, right? Like, the Mandalorians are cool. The Mandalorian armor is cool. And so you want more of it. But once you have too much of it, it becomes less special. And I remember in the Mandalorian series, they made a big deal about the Beskar being rare. And so at the start, it was still a special thing, but now there's a ton of them, like you said.
Right. And I don't know where this originated. This was just something that kind of came about in fan lore, fan group think, something about it. Before I saw the prequel movies, before those came out, I was under the impression that Boba Fett's Mandalorian armor was connected to the Clone Wars, which they kind of ended up doing in the sense that Jango Fett was the genetic prototype for the clones.
Right.
But I thought the Mandalorian armor was what the clones wore in the Clone Wars, or what some of them wore.
Yeah.
But I also thought, I also heard something like there was a story like where the Mandalorian was like a warrior race of conquerors that the Jedi wiped out like 1,000 years ago. So to have somebody wearing that armor was really unusual. So there was like a lot of different things going on. But kind of like just thinking about the character, I thought about like a few questions. Like, do you have a favorite gadget or a favorite weapon in Boba Fett's arsenal?
Yeah, I'm not sure what it's called, but and maybe it's just a grapnel. But when he shoots the thing out and he essentially is tethered to his target, I love that, especially when he can pull it back and hit them.
Yeah, that's really, really cool. Yeah, I'm going to say I'm not counting the jetpack because the jetpack is just sort of universally awesome. The mini wrist held flamethrower is just kind of cool. Yeah. Like just the fact that like have just a flame project, something that tiny, like it's really, it doesn't look like the cartridge is any bigger than a Bic lighter, but it's just like that thing. Just so
it is. It's kind of the thing that doesn't have wide utility, but you know, but when you need it, I mean, you know, when it's useful, it's useful.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The story, like we went through it, again, it was fairly straightforward, and I don't have a ton of notes because it's a bit kind of simple, but we can sort of go through that. I thought that it was interesting when we see Boba Fett's disguise as Matic, whose name they say is Sava Brek Matic, and I don't actually know if there's any more history to this character or why he invents this look, but I think it was funny that he's sort of dressed like a mummy. At least like heavily bandaged with some other like what looked like kind of metal parts. But I thought that was interesting because a lot of people said like that's how Dengar looked in Empire Strikes Back. He looked like a mummy with like metal armor on him. Like the brother.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting, an interesting cover too. And maybe your point about Dengar solidifies this, but nobody seemed to bat an eye at the fact that this guy is so heavily bandaged. And you know, partly because I mean there's still some Sarlacc scars peeking out from underneath the bandages. Clearly there's something going on there, but they're just like, okay, you know, and he's treated totally normally, which is great if they're that positive towards the disabled, but it was just interesting.
Yeah, you're right. Like nobody treats him like he just walked out of an infirmary or like the burn ward of like a hospital or everything. Like he talks about, he's like, yeah, this guy is impersonating me and he's stealing my business. And they're like, you do business looking like that? Okay, whatever. Yeah. No judgment here.
Yep, totally normal.
I did think it was cool, like in the first chapter, how Dengar kind of clocks that this isn't Boba Fett. It's like, this guy shouldn't have fallen for a trap like that, that little death trap. And then when he pulls a gun, he's like, Boba Fett wouldn't pull a gun on me like that. And just kind of, and he's like, you are not Boba Fett. And like the sort of hostility between them, I thought was kind of cool right from the jump.
Yeah, I appreciated that it was instant recognition that this wasn't Boba Fett. And I would bet Dengar knows him so well, you know, as well as anybody does. There's probably something different in how they move, you know?
Yeah. I bet he would be able to clock that just kind of in certain physical mannerisms and his gait and stuff like that might tell it off. Yeah. I always thought it was hilarious. Just the way the second chapter sort of begins on this planet where you just see these like, rows of like just dead bodies are around this village and this guy proclaiming himself a Sith Lord and he's gonna conquer their whole life, and you just cut, you turn the page and Boba Fett just backhand slaps him down.
Yeah. Well, and, I read that strike a little differently. I took it as like a throat strike.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Because he's clearly dead.
Yeah, he's like, he's basically just knife-handed this guy's larynx. So, yeah,
God, that's brutal.
Yeah, fight over.
Yeah.
And you don't have any sympathy for him because he's, you know, he's like you said, a charlatan who has killed all these people while pretending to be, you know, he's like a fake Nazi who's as bad as a Nazi or something.
You're right, yeah. And Boba Fett just like, he grabs him by the foot and flies him over to these villagers and drop him. They're like, you defeated a Sith Lord. He's like, he wasn't a Sith. And he's like, all of his like powers and everything were just tricks and gadgets in his gloves, which is funny that Boba Fett could recognize that because all of his equipment is just gadgets and stuff in his gloves.
Yep.
And he's just like, he's like, I got this guy. You're free. Give me my money.
Yeah. And he also reminded me of the fake. I mean, that guy turned out to be a good guy, but the fake Jedi in Kenobi, but
Dengar mentions he name drops a character named Manaru that's his kind of girlfriend, who was she had a psychic implant that kind of made her technopathic or something. She could like hack into computer systems and electronics with this sort of with a device in her mind. I think I'm remembering the character correctly. I like the way they expanded some of these characters in the other media. Like Dengar in particular had like a much deeper history in this version of the expanded universe, where he had a history with Han Solo. He hated Han Solo's guts because when they were much younger, they were both swoop racers, like bike racers. Basically Dengar looks the way he looks. He's got his own scars and his own cybernetics because of a horrible crash that he took on his bike, and he always blamed Han Solo for that. Boba Fett and Han Solo have this sort of professional rivalry and him trying to catch him, whereas Dengar wants to just kill Han Solo, like just destroy him. But
yeah, that makes I mean, Han Solo seems like the kind of guy who would make those kind of enemies. So that
yeah. Yeah. If you're not charmed by him, you probably hate his breathing guts.
Like, yeah.
Jodocast's ship is called the Fox Hunt, and you can see that it's like a modified version of a Lambda shuttle, like the Imperial cruiser that they show in Return of the Jedi. But the wings, both the top one and the ones on the fold on the sides, are shorter, but they're also like converted. It looks much more heavily armored and armed, definitely like a combat vehicle. Cool. I mean, like, what is the third chapter of this one is basically just it's like the start of Indiana Jones, where Jodocast is going through this temple, setting off every booby trap and just fighting his way through it. Grenades and stuff and like the laser webs. And
if Indiana Jones were armored and thus didn't have to be so careful.
There's a thing, and it's still prevalent in this version, like the collected edition. And I noticed it back when I was reading this in installments. It doesn't say there is a different colorist, but there is a major coloring change in the last chapter, like the last fourth of the book. Because prior to that, you could tell the difference between Boba Fett and Jodocast and the way they're colored. Jodocast has more of a yellow-orange part of his face mask, whereas Boba Fett's is distinctly red. Cast's colors are a little bit more muted, a little bit darker, like the gray of his suit is a little bit darker. But like you can see how different they are. But when you get to the fourth chapter, they're colored identically. And it really kind of, I think it takes not much, but just a little bit away from their fight. The fact that they look just like each other.
Yeah. And they may have been trying to achieve something with that, but we haven't talked about the art in this. I'm really impressed with it. I'm not familiar with the artist. I mean, the quality of the rendering to me is outstanding. The storytelling, I would say, is middling. I can see where he's making a point of trying to show me what's going on, but it doesn't always work. And of course, some of that could be user error, but you know, but there were times when I had to go back and double check. And the similarity between Boba Fett and Jodocast complicates that.
Yeah.
I thought they did a good job on the cover, the painted cover, which is gorgeous of making them look a little more different, but I guess he had a bigger palette to work with.
Yeah. Well, what I would say, more or less like the line work, the figure work, the way he draws the characters, the setting and everything like that is very detailed. It's very cool looking, but there are definitely points where maybe the composition of the page or the angle that he's telling from some of the action, I agree, kind of gets muddled. And the last fight is a little bit more frenetic and crazy, but it's not bad. And I do like once after they exchange a couple shots, Cast runs away and Fett, he uses the thing where he uses that grapple that's like the synth line that wraps around his ankle, but then attaches it to like this pillar, this column. So he's stuck in that way. Boba Fett can fly up after him. And he hits him with something. It looks like he's got a golf club or something. It's not that, but it's just like this long stick that he just kind of like, he kicks him and then like swings this mallet thing at his jetpack, which disables it.
Yeah. So I think I remember that stick from one of these club baton, staff, I guess, from one of the, from one of the series. I don't remember exactly who had it, but no, I thought that was great. That was when you asked me coolest gadget, I almost mentioned that, which isn't really a gadget, but it's just and it's funny because it probably wouldn't, if he had been hitting the Beskar, it probably wouldn't have done much, but he, You know, he swings it right where he needs to. And I also really love when he tethered that guy and then attached it to the pillar. That was, I thought that was great, because now he's basically a pinata, you know?
Yeah, he's going nowhere. I think it's like a collapsible baton or something. Like, I think that's what I've seen it as, just because it's like, it's something that he can kind of just store like in a pocket or on his belt or something like that. But
And there's just so much, I mean, you know, with all their technology, it's still useful just to beat somebody with a stick.
I like that they built up in the earlier chapter, the chapter three, that Jodo Cast is good at what he does. He's competent. He's a little sloppier, but it's like he's going up against the best. So he doesn't really have a chance against Boba Fett. But when Fett takes out his jetpack, Jodo Cast grabs his ankle, like, and he's like holding on for dear life. And he's like, if I fall, I'm taking you with me. And Boba Fett's like, actually, you're not. And he shoots him in the throat with a little toxin dart and everything like that. He's like, good try. You know, that was a valiant effort, you know. But
yeah, he's resourceful. I mean, the trick with the shooting the jetpack at Boba Fett, that was cool. It took that was probably the scene where I had the hardest time figuring out what happened. I mean, you know, until they, you know, in panel, and then they show the next panel, I'm like, okay, now I see what you're trying to show me. But yeah, I agree. And part of, I think the problem that this guy has is, instead of constantly trying to be better, he's always thinking about how good he already is. And
yeah,
you know, whereas Boba Fett, you never see Boba Fett thinking about how awesome he is. He's just trying to do the job, you know, to a certain standard of excellence. And he's not comparing himself to anybody else. He's just trying to be better at his job all the time.
A little bit of it gets lost by the fact that they're functionally identical. But like the thing is, like, Jodo Cast thinks he's younger and better. Because he calls Boba a fossil at times. Yeah. And by the end of it, when Boba Fett's walking away, he's like, you could have learned from this fossil if you'd actually fought for a second.
Yeah. He was surviving as a lower rank bounty hunter, right? And you don't find out how he got the Mandalorian armor. And I mean, I wouldn't pass up Mandalorian armor, because if I were in his position, I would probably paint it differently so it was clear to everybody I wasn't Boba Fett. But he really could have set himself up. He could have been like a protege, and he could have, like you said, he was talented. He could have been really successful, and he went for the short term cash.
Yeah. I did like that part where he does use the jet, as you mentioned, he uses the jetpack to bait once, because the way it's broken up is Boba Fett has snuck up behind him and has his blaster up against the back of Jodo's helmet, his head. He ignites his jetpack, like, kind of really to just push Boba Fett back to get some distance between him, and it surprises him. And I think about what befalls Boba Fett in Return of the Jedi. I was like, he's got a blind side to jetpack malfunctioning and stuff like that. Like, he's like, maybe he shouldn't be wearing these things that much, but.
It's like the trope about people not looking up, something comes at them from the trees or the ceiling. I think he has a bad habit he needs to correct.
Once Jodo Cast it's almost overkill at this point, because he gets the nerve toxin that's like paralyzes him, and he also falls 40 or 50 feet onto the ground, basically just probably breaks every bone. And he's just kind of like lying there, barely breathing. And Boba Fett strips off his jetpack, and then he strips off the helmet. He's like, let's see who you are. He's like, you're nobody. He's like, you're not anybody. And he has a line where he mentions a few of the characters, including, because Jodo Cast was not the first surrogate for Boba Fett back when Marvel still had the license and they were doing their comics. They wanted to do the same thing. That's like, Boba Fett looks awesome, but they killed him in the movie. So what do? So they created a couple of characters, these Mandalorian super commandos that kind of lived on after Boba Fett. And one of them was named Fen Shisa, had a bigger deal. And again, she kind of looked almost the same as Boba Fett, so they could have that in the comics. And it's odd because Dark Horse and Delroy Books, they didn't very often reference stuff from the Marvel comics. They definitely wanted a different continuity. So the fact that Boba Fett mentions him here, because he's like, who are you? He's like, you're not Dala, you're not Fen Shisa, you're nobody. So he's clearly indicating there are other guys walking around with the same kind of armor that he's aware of.
Yeah, Dala, I looked up also is associated with Fenshisa. Actually, I appreciated the amount of lore. I mean, there's a point where they talk about how the Hutts got their homeworld and how they stole it from the
Yoshi. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but the it's not so much world building as world acknowledging, but there's a ton of it in here. And I appreciated that.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. Yeah. What did you think of like the final fate where I mean, he's paralyzed. The jetpack is about to explode and he gives them three vials, like kind of puts them in front of him and says, one of these is the antidote. Of course, he can't move to grab one of the vials and maybe the other to kill him. Like, it's cruel, but it also just seems like a little bit unnecessary.
I'm going to contrast that with something earlier, because when he took out the fake Sith Lord, he said something, I would leave some of the money for their orphanage if I didn't have to spend the money on my next job. And his next job is hunting down Jodocast. And so because he basically had to use the money to hire the guy so he could kill him. So on one hand, they're showing him as having like there's a little bit of altruism there. And just that he thought about something for the orphans. I mean, he's an orphan, quote unquote, real Mandalorians are, you know, they're all about the foundlings. He has some connection to them, to some degree. So that was interesting because they're showing this positive side. But then, yeah, they close it with him just being a sadist. Just because this guy ticked him off, you know. And I don't know. I mean, I'm comfortable with them showing that Boba Fett is not a good guy. But you're right.
I think it's a little bit too much that he puts down the three vials, because I think that makes it a little bit more like, it's like, okay, he says one of these is the cure. It's like, well, are the others poisoned? Will they kill him faster? Or are they just placebos? Are they nothing? Like, I think it would have been interesting. It's like, here's the one thing that can cure you, the one thing that can save you. If you're strong enough to drink it fast enough, you might be able to get out of here before the explosion, but I know you're not strong enough. And that sort of temptation, that seeing the last glimmer of hope that you can survive, but it's just out of reach. Putting the three possible options out there complicates that. And I just think that was a little bit unnecessary. I think if it had just been the one vial, but he knew that this guy is paralyzed, he's broken, he's not going to be able to do anything. Even if he took it and he could move again, he's so messed up, he's so injured, that the from the sounds of the explosion, it's going to take him down anyway.
So. Yeah, I agree with you. The so if it'd been one vial, it could have been, hey, I think you're weak. I don't think you deserve to wear the armor you're wearing or were wearing before I stripped it off of you. The prove me wrong. You know, I'll give you an opportunity to do that. But the with the other two vials, it also makes me wonder, like you said, what's in those vials? Why does he have them? Is one of them the nerve toxin itself that he would carry? Is one of them like oil for a gadget? I don't understand.
I can definitely see just for preparation, having the antidote to the nerve toxin on hand.
Right.
Because if you got infected by your own toxin, if you shot it at your foot or you shot it at the wrong person, or you just need to cure whoever you did shoot for whatever reason. I think having the antidote to the poison you carry is a good just safety consideration.
Yeah. If you shot it at a target and like you needed him mobile now, you know, right.
I don't want to drag you. You need to walk. So take this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably my last thing for the story. What's your favorite? I mean, I guess this could be through the whole comic, but I was really kind of just thinking about their last fight. Like, what's your favorite action beat or trick or maneuver in their fight? Is it the sort of grapple around his ankle, or is it something?
Yeah. It's the pinata thing. He won me over when he attached the line to the pillar, and it's like, now you're mine. You know, just I own you now.
it's that same page. It's when he kicks him. Something about the pose of that kick, because he's like, he's swinging his arms back over his right shoulder and he's kicking his right foot, but it's kicking across to his left side. That's like a almost like a superhero kick. That's like almost a Spider-Man pose. It's just a little bit away from like a superhero, like Spider-Man type of pose, that agility that you see with somebody more like that.
Yeah, I agree. There's so you see stuff in movies and comics sometimes where it's like that's a maximum power strike.
Yeah.
And normally in a fight, you would not have the opportunity to do that because you're trying to stay out of the guy's way. You're he's blocking and you're trying to hit him at the same time. So you're always every strike is a compromise.
Yeah.
But every so often there's an opportunity that happens. And there's really two of them in this one. And one of them is that throat strike and the other one is that kick.
Yeah, I was saying Spider-Man, but actually, I think maybe because of he's holding the baton too. Like, I can see Nightwing or Daredevil in that position. But for like the fact that they're in the middle of the air and it's the jetpack, but like in that terms of like the body posture, the pose, the configuration, I can see Nightwing or Daredevil in that same spot.
So. Yep.
Yeah, this was fun. I mean, I didn't want to read. I mean, there are Mandalorian comics, but I think. For now, at least, I think they're all just adaptations of the TV show, the series that we've got so far. But I wanted something to kind of tie into that movie. And I was like, you know what? I haven't talked about Boba Fett in a long time. He was my favorite thing in pop culture for a short time when I was younger. So I wanted to read a story. And there were a couple of different ones that I looked at. But I thought this one was a good starter book that anybody could take a look at. And maybe people, even if they were reading the Dark Horse comics, they might've slept on this one because it originally came out serialized in that magazine, but this was fun. It's a straightforward one. And you get everything you like about Boba Fett in this one. He's a man of few words and surgically precise actions. Like he doesn't overdo it. I think that's like, you see that in the way you write, like that throat strike to the quote unquote Sith Lord. The way it's just like he doesn't go out of his way with that guy. He just one chop to the throat and that dude is dead.
Yeah, that's also what's a little uncomfortable about the elaborate thing with the vials is like it seems like wasted motion, which is not him. But yeah, I agree. I thought it was great. I thought it's kind of a pure story. Other than that little bit at the end. It's an excellent character study and study of the setting of like, this is the environment you're in. And it was a neat scene of the New Republic, you know, that they really don't have full control of, I mean, which matches up with other things we've seen of law and order, and nobody ever does, but it's a little bit Wild West post-imperial and it's a neat environment.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you were here, Captain, to help me talk about this one. This was a lot of fun. I hope you enjoyed it.
I really appreciate it, Ryan. Thanks for having me on. Nobody else is going to have me on to talk Star Wars, so I appreciate your charity.
Not charity. It's you're doing me the favor by being here. Before we go, I do have to give you the traditional Star Wars Galactic questionnaire. Three new questions, or at least most of them are new questions. But the first one, as it's your namesake, would you rather captain an independent merchant or smuggling ship, like perhaps the Millennium Falcon, or a big military capital ship?
Oh, so you're talking to somebody who's actually done military leadership in the big bureaucracy. I will take I will take the independent smuggling ship 100 times out of 100. That is an easy one.
Less people to answer to, less people to be accountable for.
There are so many times when you know exactly what needs to be done and you don't
people
get permission
to
do it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I get it. Nice. All right. Question number two. What is your lightsaber color?
Oh, man. My lightsaber color is dark blue. I'll just be specific. It's the blue in the field in the American flag.
Okay. Very cool. Very cool. I like that detail. Nice. Yeah. Third question. This one is like an easy layup. Are you planning to see The Mandalorian and Grogu in theaters?
I absolutely am. So I'm looking forward to a revival of that and seeing what they do with it. So, and the trailers look good.
Me too. I loved the first season. I really liked the second season until they brought Boba Fett back, and I thought that kind of complicated things, but I really enjoyed it. The third season, I thought, kind of lost its way, and it was less about Din Djarin's story and more about the return of the Mandalorian as a people and a race, and having Bo-Katan. And I thought her story was good. I liked the story. I just thought they sort of lost focus on whose show it was. But if this movie can kind of recenter and give us a good story, I don't think this is going to be like a huge galaxy-changing event. I think it's going to be a more standalone kind of adventure, just told over 2 hours instead of their normal one. So that's kind of the expectations I'm going into. And if it's that, I'm cool with that. I just want to be entertained. I want to see these characters on the screen again for the first time in a minute. So.
Yeah, and I agree. And there's always been kind of a Western quality to The Mandalorian when the stories are just him and Grogu. And you could totally do that kind of a, like you said, a lone wolf and cub story with them. And it doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be Return of the Jedi that completely resets the stage, you know? But I'm curious, what are your answers to the first two questions?
I don't think I've done a show since this. I would certainly captain a smaller private vehicle. I would want more freedom and autonomy. I don't think I have the temperament for the military, hence why I never had any interest in joining the military. I'm fascinated by the military and the kind of structure and stories about that. Obviously, G.I. Joe has been one of my predominant fandoms for my entire life, but never thought about joining any branch of the service. And also the fact that I really messed up my leg when I was in high school. I don't think I could even physically do that. I didn't think about it. You reminded me, and listeners, I went to Disney World a month, 2 months ago, and had the opportunity to visit the Galaxy's Edge, the Star Wars land part of the park, which was amazing. And at some point I'll do more of a deep dive into my experiences with that. It was a lot of fun. But one of the things I was most looking forward to was doing the Smuggler's Run ride, where you get to pilot the Millennium Falcon. And it's like an hour and a half wait, and then you walk aboard and you're going through the hallways and it looks cool. But then they separate you into groups. This was just me, because I was complaining this endlessly to Angie, and she's like, okay, that's way too much. They have six seats in the cockpit, which the Millennium Falcon does not have six seats. It has four seats, but Disney has to capitalize. They have to get more people in that room. So they make them parties of four, or parties of six going in there. I only had three in my personal party. It was me, Angie, and my son, Reese, and then three total strangers, another couple and one person going in by themselves. And the way we just lined up, the way it shook up, we were just assigned parts, and I didn't get to sit in the captain's chair. I was in the back left operating the shields, I wasn't a gunner or a pilot. I was like one of the shield operators on the port side. Which all it does is just, you're basically just pushing a button when it lights up, and the whole ride itself, like, so that part of the experience hurt it for me. And then the ride itself, it's fine, but it's not that much different than the old Star Tours ride that's been at Disney World and Disneyland for decades. Like, I rode that thing in like the 90s when I first really became a Star Wars fan. It's not that much different, except it's got Hondo, the pirate guy from the Clone Wars and Rebels, who's one of my favorite characters. But during the game, you kind of figure out, you know, a little bit of this guy goes a long way. It's like, yeah, you really don't want him talking to you for 5 or 10 minutes straight.
But the lead-in is almost better than the ride in that sense.
Yeah. It turned out that ride was a big disappointment. Probably the only disappointment, other than a few rides throughout the park that were broken or weren't working when we went there. But everything else about the Star Wars land, Galaxy's Edge, that type of thing, was awesome. So much so the fact that we were talking about, like, as soon as we left, we were talking about going back. And I was like, can't go back right away. We need to recharge our accounts. But yeah, that ride was a disappointment. Everything else was awesome. And I'll talk more about that at some point. But
Yeah, I look forward to hearing it because we've been there too. They do a great job of building the world around you. And to me, you feel like you're in it. And that is the best part to me. But
For the lightsaber color, I mean, I actually got a chance to put this into motion. I've always been sort of attracted to what I thought were sort of the niche colors that didn't appear in the original movies. So I got a chance to build my own lightsaber at Disney when we went to that whole thing. That's one of the things. And I built one, and you got to customize. You got to pick what your crystal color is that affects the blade. And I picked a purple one. So I got a lightsaber with a purple blade. But then in the store next to it, you can also get my separate crystals if you want to change the color. So I also got a yellow one so I can alternate between. And then Ange got a lightsaber of her own, which she had a vision for what she wanted to do with the lightsaber. And then our son Reese quickly hijacked her idea and turned it into a black Sith lightsaber with a red blade. But we also got an extra one for that, which is a white blade. So we got a whole bunch of options. None of them are the blue and green traditional Jedi lightsaber blades that you think of. So we don't have represented, but those are good. So.
All right. I only have two other things I have to remember to do. One of them is invite you next time you're in Central Florida, let me know and I'll see if we can meet up.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The other thing, this the first time, so we went to Epcot went to Disney on our honeymoon, and Epcot was one of the days. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't Epcot. It's the regular part. Anyway, the
Magic Kingdom.
But the Star Tours thing that you're talking about, which park is that in?
That's Hollywood Studios.
Hollywood Studios. Okay. We went there and I freaked out somebody there because going into the ride, I did my Wookiee impression. So, that's it.
That's good. That's good.
Thank you.
I used to be able to do that really well. And I don't think, I don't know. I think my voice changed. I don't know if I can get it that well anymore. I used to be really good at that.
Yeah.
That was good. That sounded good. Well, Captain Entropy, thank you very much for appearing on this episode of Give Me Those Star Wars. Any other appearances on, either Fire and Water Network shows or other podcast shows that you've got either coming up or recently that you want to mention?
So just did an appearance with Professor Allen on his Eyes and Ears show on the Relatively Geeky Podcast Network. We were covering humor comics for April. I have an Under Siege appearance coming up on the Right On Network with Tim Price. And Longbox Crusade. I was on an Amazing Spider-Man Chronicles recently. Cool. And I had a lot of fun recording all of those. So
very cool.
So thanks for giving me the opportunity to plug them.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Love to share in the love with everybody else. We love the whole community. Yeah, that's awesome. Very cool. Check those out, folks. In the meantime, at the time that this episode comes out, The Mandalorian and Grogu should be dropping in just a few days. I hope you see it. I hope you enjoy it. I hope it's good. But yeah, until then, until next time, Give Me Those Star Wars is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for the show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com, or you can email me at ourdailypodcast@gmail.com. You can also support shows like this on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/FW podcast to support your favorite show on the Fire and Water Network. Thanks for listening, and remember, the Force will be with you always.